We are with political royalty. The former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, the most, I think in many ways, still the most powerful person in the Democratic Party. My wife interviewed her the other day and said, you are, her book is The Art of the Power, bestseller number one, I think.
Yeah.
And my wife said, you are the most powerful woman in America. And her response was, pretty soon I'm going to be the second most powerful woman. So it's so great to have you here, Madam Speaker. Let me start off. You have been to a number of conventions,
mm-hmm.
and you do, and there's an incredible feeling of optimism, excitement, energy here in Chicago. But you also remember 2016, 1988, even your convention in San Francisco, mm-hmm. where there also was a great feeling of excitement and optimism. Why do you think it's different this time?
Well, the two other conventions that you mentioned were when we nominated the first woman, Vice President of the United States, Geraldine Ferraro. That was very exciting. It was thunderous. It was so different. It was so different and so wonderful. I'll never forget the floor shaking with exuberance when she was nominated. And then 2016, the nomination of Hillary Clinton. And, well, whom I did, always thought in this era of our time, the most qualified person nominated for president. More qualified than her husband, he would admit. Obama has admitted. George Bush may not admit, but nonetheless, formidable. But, okay, it did. For some reason, what we can go into, no use litigating an election, but nonetheless, it didn't happen. But I did say that why it's different now, Hillary did not win the election, but she won the campaign. She won the campaign. She went out there, she put forth all of that, and again, we can go back, forth, Comey, all the rest of that, but nonetheless, she was very positive. And as she said last night, she started to break that glass ceiling. I think one of the reasons it isn't broken, because it's really marble. So if you're going to break it, you got to really break the thing. And that's what I had to do to become speaker. That's what they'll have to do. And so I think we're at a different time. People have gotten signed. Hillary really was a trailblazer. I mean, not that Geraldine wasn't. I'm just talking about it. This is more recent. And the difference, the distinction between the Democrats and Republicans' vision for the future is so drastically different. And the, shall we say, the assault on women, the respect or lack of respect for women is so, it evokes so much negative attitude. I think that we have the makings of success, but it's not hard. This is a campaign. This is, I told the Democrats this morning, I said, you know the Olympic gold, silver, bronze, honor to be an Olympian, 0.5% of us, 0.5 seconds. It's all that close, and all of these races could be that close. So it's going to take a lot of work. You've heard me say, we must mobilize and own the ground. We must have a message that is inspiring to fuel that operation, but also progressive, bold, but not menacing, and instead unifying for the country. And the third M, mobilization, message, money. And that's coming in just fine.
You know, I'm so glad you said that, because you were on a British broadcast a week or two ago, and believe it or not, we have listeners in the UK, and they wrote and they said, she was cut off after the first M. So would you please tell us and find out what the second and third M is? So all of you Brits out there, you now know the second and third M. What would you, I'm sure she'll talk to you, what would you like to hear from Kamala Harris on Thursday night, rather?
The best advice I ever received when I ran, and I never intended to run for office, so I needed advice, was be yourself. Just show them what is in your heart in terms of your empathy for the American people. Show them your vision of America. Why did you ever get involved in all of this? Show them your vision, show them your values, show them your connection to them, what's in your heart. But she, again, that's not specific policy advice. My policy advice, as I got in trouble during the Joe Biden campaign. Alexandra had it in her movie. I got caught saying to Joe Biden, do not go too far to the left. That is no way to win the presidency. Says I, a left-wing liberal from San Francisco, I can tell you.
You, one thing that you deeply care about, is, as well as the presidency, is the House.
Yeah.
And how has that dynamic changed, the down ballot, if you will, dynamic changed in the last month? And how do you feel the Democrats will do on November 5th in the House races?
Well, so much has changed in terms of the dynamic. Almost immediately, like I was at an event for one of the Illinois members yesterday, and his campaign, rural Illinois, so a challenging, what we call a frontline race that we have to really work to win, and we will. He got like 1,100 volunteers the first day, not to mention a lot of small donors calling in, and members were seeing that all over the country. I will say, to the credit of our frontline members, and the House is, I just love it. It's just, mm-hmm. Rahm quoted James as something about me and how much I wanted to win in 2006. Maybe he will use the term, but in any event, mobilization, many more volunteers, money, small donors, all of that coming in. It's almost found money. It's new. It's important. And again, these are people with a message that has to go straight down the middle. And they just feel they have more of a chance. Now, most of them had said to me before, I'm still going to win my race if the president's only 5 points behind me. If he goes beyond that, I won't be here. But 5 points I can handle. If he's down 5 points, I can still win. Now they feel more confident, but nobody is taking anything for granted. Assume nothing. You know what assume is? It makes an ass of you and me. That's what the word spells.
James Carville.
So,
that's you and I are roughly the same generation. We'll get into the details here.
Yes.
But you were a young girl growing up in Baltimore. I was a young boy growing up in South Louisiana. And we took different paths, but at some level, we loved politics. Mm-hmm. We just loved it. And try to explain to people what it is that a young girl in Baltimore, a young boy in South Louisiana, mm-hmm. in the 50s, what is it that attracted us to this business of politics? Why did we just grow up loving it and want to be in it so much?
You begin.
Well, I mean, mine was totally shaped by race, because mm-hmm. I just came to the conclusion that it just wasn't right. Mm-hmm. So that a little bit different, because that was so, everything in Louisiana was so racial. But I think what you have done is, I think I'll let you speak for yourself, but you saw it as a vehicle to help people. That there was some way that if you did this, my motivation was, I just think black people are getting the short end of the stick. I didn't have a solution to it. I didn't have any kind of a rationale behind it. But I think that you, more than anybody, use hard-earned, some people say ruthless. I would agree.
Oh, no.
I would hope that's true. But I think you used it to the end. I don't mind it. Okay, but I think you use it to end to help people. And I want you to talk about some of the things in your career where you have really been able to do something that has really impacted other people's lives.
Okay. Well, I consider the Affordable Care Act the most impactful initiative that I was engaged in, had a major responsibility for, and that if we had not succeeded, I would have taken full responsibility. But since we did succeed, it has many, many parents, especially the President of the United States, Barack Obama. That was really important. His vision, his knowledge of all the issues and the rest, his sticking with us when others didn't.
Right.
was really important. But my caring for people that you said was your motivation is something that we share. I was born in a completely different situation. I was born in Baltimore, in the Italian section where I grew up, where my parents died, where our family, that's who we were. And so we were devoutly Catholic, staunchly patriotic, proud of our Italian heritage, and staunchly democratic. That was part of the staunchly democratic. But and our upbringing was that we all had a responsibility to other people, and that's why you engaged in civic activity. Right. If that was political, okay. But it was a connection between the Gospel of Matthew, when I was hungry, you fed me, when I was homeless, you sheltered me, you know, that gospel, and connected to the agenda of the Democratic Party respecting a separation of church and state. So it was our moral responsibility to care for people.
So I was pre-Vatican II, Altar Boy, I could still rack off a pretty good VDR. But I want to tell you a story about Nancy Pelosi. Remember Gene Taylor?
Yeah.
So Gene was a Democratic congressman from Mississippi Gulf Coast.
That's right.
And I see him, I have a place I go on the weekend. And I always see him at the Yacht Club. He said, James, he just can't believe it, Nancy Pelosi. She came down here after Katrina. She got us everything we needed. She asked every question we needed to know. And of course, he got beat by some Tea Party jerk. But, and Nancy Pelosi, and give Trent Lott some credit here, literally the finest piece of infrastructure is a bill over the bay. And literally built that. And that's what Gene Taylor will tell you. That Nancy Pelosi saved South Mississippi. That's helping people.
Yes, well, he was lovely. He then later became a Republican, but
he never did. Okay, he might have.
It was a great story, James. Until then, you were on a roll. You may want to. I can say you heard this. I told you this. I had dinner the other night with Bill and Rich Daley, the former mayor of Chicago.
Yeah.
And Rich is, I think he was a really great mayor here. And I'm not talking about his father, about his son.
I love him.
And he, but he's old, you know, he's older and he's a little bit sour on a lot of people in politics. He doesn't say very nice things about a lot of, until suddenly I ask so-and-so, I mentioned Nancy Pelosi and his eyes lit up and he said, that's my kind of Paul. I love Nancy Pelosi. So the left-wing San Francisco Democrat and the mayor of Chicago, are simpatico. Let me ask you this, Madam Speaker. There's always talk about the schisms in the Democratic Party, the left and the right and today. Are those schisms a problem, and how do you address them?
No, I don't think they're a problem. We are a Democratic Party. We are not lockstep Republican Party, where everything comes from on high, and that's what it is. We are a Democratic Party. The job title in Congress, if we're just talking in Congress, the job title and the job description are one and the same. Representative. I represent San Francisco. Other people represent their districts in Mississippi or wherever it happens to be. So when we come together, we have a different approach in some cases as to how we build consensus. The press likes to make more of a fuss. I mean, we have some on the way left in our party. They don't like me saying it. It ain't that many. And they don't change too many minds. They've never really obstructed us from doing anything. So, but even within the really more, shall we say, closer together difference between Democrats and Republicans, we build consensus as we prioritize and go forward. I when people say that, I think, well, we're Democrats. We have differences of opinion. That's a healthy thing, in my view. And I mean, I always say I'm a weaver. I have to weave I'm at the loom. I used to be, I'm not now. At the loom, weaving every thread together, making sure every member in the caucus knows that this tapestry will not be complete unless they're all respected and in it. And when we have our decisions to make, we build consensus, not unanimity necessarily, but I would hope that the respect we have for saying we cannot weave this tapestry unless we're respecting everyone. You know, well, you'll know what I say next. Tomorrow is another day.
Oh, if we get up.
It's another bill, and it's another, well, then the next metaphor I would use is the kaleidoscope. One time, our caucus this side of the room, all be versus this side of the room. The next day, the back of the room versus the front of the room. Everybody is a resource to each other. So you don't want to weaken anybody that is a potential recourse. And I would say that goes across the aisle as well.
You know, if you do win the House, and I expect you will.
Hey, did you hear he said if?
What did he say?
He said if.
If.
May I correct myself? When you win the House, Madam Speaker, Hakeem Jeffries is likely to have a margin comparable to yours, and which is challenging.
No, I want more. I think we can get more, but nonetheless,
all right, all right, you can tell me how many more.
Well, right now we just need four to win the majority. Four. We'll win that, but I want more than that. I want more than that because then that gives you, shall we say, some in the pocket so that people can roll a little easier. But it is, here's how I say it. Last time you heard everybody say we were going to lose 30 or 40 seats. What were they smoking? 30 or 40 seats. We knew that wasn't true. And I almost thought that we could hold the House. I never thought we'd lose five seats in New York. But we did. And so we'll win those back. We already won one back. We'll win a few more back. And we'll win others in the rest of the country. But this is very cold-blooded,
ruthless,
reptilian decision-making.
Right? Is it ruthless?
No, it's not ruthless.
Oh, please be ruthless.
I don't know why they say ruthless.
I don't know. I like
strong.
Okay.
Cold-blooded.
All right. Okay.
It doesn't mean that you're hurting somebody. It just means they might not be your choice right now. Work it up. You know, you might make it next time. But so I knew that we put our resources in the races with a total contrast. Imagine a woman's right to choose, gun violence protection, climate, democracy, just a few things where these people had taken votes, these Republicans had taken votes against really the wishes of the people in their district, if they only knew, and we had to make sure they knew. And we did, and we didn't lose 30 or 40, we lost five, and five in New York. So we will win those back. But I think we can win more than that, especially with this. I mean, I had people telling me, I'm not sure I'm going to get my children able to, I don't think they'll vote. They're just turned off. I had people who are chairs of party in different states say, I maybe get one of my three kids to vote. They're just not interested. And we heard this again and again, and now it's all different. Now it's all different. The difference that has been made in the generous and selfless decision that the president made is quite important to us. It's only an opportunity, though. We still have to fight really hard. MMM. And I have three no's. No wasted time. No underutilized resource. That means intellectually, organizationally, and no regrets. The day after the election, if only we had done more. What could we have done more? We have to win this election.
Let me try one more and turn it
back to James.
So we're
going to win. I would like them to have more of a, 10 or something like that.
A margin of 10.
When we won,
so you have 10 in your pocket.
Help in 06. Right. Now we won like 31 seats.
I remember it well. We have a Dave Wasserman here who's the prognostic. He can tell you what our up and lower, but the way he sees the up and lower range here. He usually gets things right, but we can tell him hello on the way out.
No, but it's a decision. A winning election is a decision, and I say this all the time. You make a decision to win, and then you make every decision in favor of winning in terms of organization, in terms of messaging, non-menacing, and in terms of money and how you use it. And the biggest decision of all is the candidate.
So Al has a question. Just I want to make a statement on national, but a comment. When it came to the events of this summer, you and I came at it from two different directions, two different people, two different things, but I will say this. I think we did our duty, okay? I really do. I think both of us felt like we had a duty to do. We never spoke about it or collaborated, but I think at the end of the day, I can comfortably say that we did our duty.
And well, our president generously made his decision.
Right, I understand, and I don't want to revisit with anything, but I think the president made a really wise decision, and I'm very, very happy about everything, and I know that you had to do what you thought was in the best interest of the United States, and I think you did, and I congratulate you for it.
Well, everyone had their roles in all of this.
Right. Yeah.
So let me just try one. When you win the White House, and when you win the House, and when you keep the Senate, what will be the major priorities, or what will be the top priorities next year when you have a chance to, you know, do things like you did before?
Well, of course, we'll have new leadership. Hakeem will be the speaker. Chuck, that will be new. Chuck will be the majority leader more strongly, and then we'll have a new president. But one of the few unfinished businesses that are essential to our democracy, I'm not talking about priorities among issues, because that's a decision that is timing and opportunity and personalities and what you think you can accomplish. But one thing that I think is absolutely essential and that I have been fighting for a while, unsuccessfully because of the 60-vote filibuster rule in the Senate, but okay, let's see if we can get rid of that, is the
For the People
Act. The
filibuster or the Senate? Hmm? You want to get rid of the filibuster or the Senate?
One thing at a time. First thing I do is send them 100 white powdered wigs. Because if this is where you want to be, then this is it. I mean, it's one thing. I mean, we take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. This beautiful document was a vision of our founders. They had to make a compromise to pass. Little did they know that there would be such disparity among states, that we in California would have 40 million people, and our neighbor in, like, Idaho would have fewer constituents than I have practically, and both have two senators. Okay, so that's the Constitution we take an oath to protect. But to add a 60-vote requirement on top of that is minority rule to the nth degree, and they must get rid of it. And my goal in all of this, and I'm just relentless on it and will continue to be, is the For the People Act. It's our voting bill, including our voting rights bill, the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill. The For the People Bill is our bill to democratize democracy. John Lewis wrote the first 300 pages of the bill, even though it's not named for him. They took the name for the other bill, which was, they were one bill. But the reason we had to split it was because we had to build the constitutional record for the Voting Rights Bill. And so it had to go a little slower path. But what it does the first part of it is the 300 pages John Lewis wrote, to stop voter suppression, to prevent, how about this one, voting nullification, which they're not uninclined to do, you know what I'm saying? All that, okay, so that piece. Then it has nonpartisan redistricting. The only way you're gonna free up really some of these districts is to have nonpartisan redistricting, okay. And that doesn't necessarily help us with numbers, but it helps the country with more fairness. Okay, that. The next is to respect the grassroots by having matching funds for small donations, at the public expense. And then the fourth thing, and this is the biggest thing that has the most opponents, is to disclose big, dark, special interest money in our elections. This is such a big deal. Oh, corporate America hates this. Because as long as they don't have to tell their employees their clients, their customers, their community, how much big money they're putting, dark money into these. 24/7, the gun industry is just making and selling guns and big money into these races. It's not the $5,000 contribution from the NRA. It's the big, dark money that goes into elections, not even talking about guns. And then you have pharma, and then you have fossil fuel industry. Give me $1 billion and I'll undo the IRA. That's what, what's his name? I don't use it. To me, it's a foul word, says to the fossil fuel industry. So this bill, this says to people, your vote is, your voice and your vote is as important as anybody in our country. To young people, that organizing, it's not a dead end because of voter suppression and the rest of that. You know it better than anybody about what the needs are, because John really took us down this path from his own experience. So that is the priority issue. And if you can suppress that big dark money, or at least disclose it so that people will know, or it will be less, then you can get a gun bill. You can get better reduction of cost of prescription drug. This bill that we did now, what was celebrated by the president, and is something we've been trying. 606, remember that? Right. 606, one of them was enabling the Secretary of HHS to negotiate for lower prices. It's the only one of the six that we couldn't pass in the Senate, 60, blah, blah, blah. But it was a triumph to have it. And it'll save hundreds of billions of so much money to individuals, but also to the taxpayers paying a lot of the Medicare costs. So we think that democratizes the democracy.
Madam Speaker, we've been given the hook back there. I can see Ian is standing up. James, you know, when we have had a conversation with the number one author on the best-selling list, The Art of Power, with the most effective House Speaker probably in the history of the institution, and for 11 more weeks, the most powerful woman in America, you know, we may have to retire. We've peaked.
Well, let me just say, I didn't say I would become number two. I said I would relinquish the title.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
One more, a slight observation.
I mean, that means I would
we
just go to
be
the
short,
bottom of
James.
I'll be as short as I possibly can.
Well,
okay.
That's a test.
So, I never liked being called a white Democrat or a Southern Democrat or a male Democrat. I never liked it when someone called you a San Francisco Democrat. We're Democrats, period. Everything else is secondary. But to be a Democrat, now just these young people, we're part of a coalition. Mm-hmm. And I think you understand that, because if you're in a coalition and you're comfortable, you're not in a coalition. You're in something else. How were you able to so effectively work and get these unanimous votes all across the spectrum to speak? I know it wasn't easy. What's the secret to being a leader of a coalition?
I give all the credit to my members. Okay. They have courage. Courage is a really important part of all of this. We want them to have conviction and commitment and build consensus. But at the end of the day, it takes courage. And, oh, somebody's baby made this for me today, so I forgot I had it on. It takes courage. But again, it's listening to them, and everybody has to give a little for some of this. You know, in other words, if we're going to have the Affordable Care Act, this is a big deal. People think that we must go back there and see a piece of paper and vote on it. This is, takes enormous amount of work and negotiation for every piece of it. And quite frankly, the most difficult, the most challenging part of the bill goes to the question that you ask. Regional disparity. You might not think that people said, oh, it's abortion. No, we knew that wasn't in the bill. We just had to make sure people knew that. Regional disparity. And so people would say, I'm paying all this money. You want us to pass a bill that perpetuates bad policy in certain parts of the country because they want it grandfathered in. For example, on funding for like Medicare, Medicaid, all of that, in San Francisco, we have high performance and low compensation. In Florida, they have the exact reverse. Low performance and high compensation. Well, especially people in the Midwest were like, we do our work very hard to have the best performance, and for the best performance, you get the low compensation. You could have repeat readmissions. Is this more than you ever want to know on the subject?
That's all right. But anything you say, Madam.
But nonetheless, this is what kept us up until 3 a.m. on Friday morning, Friday night, going to Saturday morning, and we're bringing the bill to the floor on Sunday. But we had the votes. But it was so you're always listening. What is it? And I have to say this. Let me put up a self-serving sign for myself right now. Self-serving. Okay.
Please.
There's my experience for all those years as a legislator, as an appropriator, just held me in such good stead to say, no this, no that, we did this then, we did this then, this is no fear to you. So not just me, but other members who brought their expertise to the table. So this was not a bill that happened in those months. It was something that we had been building for, and that people brought to George Miller, Henry Waxman, first Charlie Rangel, then Levin, and so that. But not only them, all the other members brought their knowledge to the table. Do you know what I'm saying to you? This was a congressionally written bill.
For
as
any
opposed
of you,
to a executive branch written bill.
For any of you out there who want to know more about how she did it, how she worked her magic, by Art of the Power. It tells so many fascinating stories and gets into all that. Madam Speaker, I can't tell you what an honor it was.
Do we have any predictions on the election here?
Well, we're taking yours. Yeah, you're going to have a margin of 10 in the House.
Stay disciplined, stay focused, don't get distracted, and you win. Be unfocused, undisciplined, you get distracted, you lose.
Now, just among us, don't tell this to anybody. This is just for us, okay? In 06, Rahm said to me, they wanted me, there was a suggestion that we wanted to do something. Some of our members objected to it because they thought it was uncomplimentary to the Congress. But I said, we're going to do that, okay? So when I said we're going to do that, Rahm said, that B really wants to win.
I couldn't think of a higher compliment. I really couldn't. I love bitches and I love winning. I got to tell you, I like them both.
Well, we're going to wrap it up because the staff says you have to go, and I cannot thank you enough.
This has been wonderful. I'm sorry it took so long to explain to you how we got this done, but it's complicated and it takes time. But it's a courage. I would always just attribute to the courage of the members because some of these ideas are new to them. And some are old to them, and they want something new. But nonetheless, we saw an opportunity of a generation to pass the affordable, accessible. We call it affordable care because affordability is accessibility. It isn't a very glamorous name. The Republicans gave it a glamorous name, Obamacare. What's his name says Obamacare sucks, but he's wrong. It cures. And we were not only able to pass it, but to save it. But the thing about it was that when, I'll just tell you this one story, when Teddy passed away, it was so sad for all of us for so many reasons. Got even sadder when the Republican won in Massachusetts. Remember? Mm-hmm. What his name was, Brown? And the press came to me and they said,
Scott Brown.
You are dead. Then the beautiful diplomatic way that the press has of saying, you are dead. You're not going anyplace. It's over for you. And I said, no, not really. We're still going to pass. We are not letting an opportunity of a generation pass us by. There is nothing that will stand in our way. To which I said, self-serving again, if there's a wall there, we'll push open the gate. If that doesn't work, we'll climb the fence. If that doesn't work, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in. But we're not letting anything stand in our way. So then after we passed it, he said, which one did you do? Which one did you do? I said, we pushed open the gate. because we had not only our members, which were who were courageous, few in the pocket, few were courageous, but all of the outside mobilization. And if I leave you with one thought, it is that outside mobilization makes all the difference. Lincoln said, public sentiment is everything. With it, you can accomplish almost anything. Without it, practically nothing. But for people to, public sentiment to prevail, people have to know. And that's what we had to do. But it was all of those people, diagnosis, every illness, every disability, everything, all of those people pushing open that gate, and that not only helped us pass it, but to save it. Onward to victory, gold, silver, bronze, honored to be an Olympian. Let's go for the gold.
That's the way to end this. Thank you so much, Madam Speaker.
Lovely to see you both.
Thank you.